The Black Sticks have scored in the opening couple of moments.
Oh, full time. We've just won the World Championships. Wow.
Inside Edge with Angela Pulverendi
on ABC Local Radio.
The word icon is perhaps used liberally these days, but boy, does it appropriately describe my next guest. She won Wimbledon twice. She was the first Indigenous sports person to do so, almost a decade apart, and once as the mother of a three-year-old daughter. In all, she won 7 Grand Slam single titles and 92 professional tournaments. Not bad for a painfully shy little girl from Barrowin who began her career hitting a hairless tennis ball against the wall with a paddle her dad made from an apple cart. She has been voted Australian of the Year, inducted into the Australian and International Hall of Fame, and aptly named a national living treasure. Dropping by to join her over the next hour is the man who's been by her side for almost 40 years, the dashing Englishman with whom she has created a life, a family, and a foundation that has encouraged, supported, and mentored thousands and thousands of Indigenous and Islander kids around the country. But before we find out more about that, let's step back in time to 1980 and the final moments of the Wimbledon Women's Grand Final.
The tension in the crowd is so powerful you can feel it. Second serve is right, a forehand return. A drop shot from Chrissy Lloyd. Oh! Oh! It teetered, it tightrope walked on top of the net and it came back and fell over on her side and it gives match point 3 of them.
Mrs. Lloyd to serve. 3-6.
Oh, what a sad, sad shot that was for Chrissy Lloyd.
Could we have quiet, please, ladies and gentlemen?
Match point against her. 3 of them now. She serves to the left-hand court. What a brave effort it was to try that one. She serves at match point against her. A backhand return high, high, and out.
Mrs. Lloyd serving. 4-6.
4-6, but still match point against her. She serves right-hand court. From the Roy Box end, gets a left court.
Service.
Still match point, and it's so dark, and she serves, and that's right down the centre. She doesn't go up, but backhand chip. In comes Lloyd on a forehand cross court. Cawley a ball, forehand down the line. Lloyd lets her backhand, and Yvonne Cawley has won the title after 9 years. The longest interval between 2 single titles that a woman has ever achieved at Wimbledon, equaling the record of Bill Tilden.
Yvonne Goolagong, welcome to Inside Edge.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
It's such an honour to be sitting in front of you,
you
and to have this time with you. 1980 Wimbledon, does it feel like yesterday or quite a while ago?
Actually, it made me feel like it was just yesterday because the Women's Tennis Association invited myself and I invited my older sister back to Wimbledon because she'd never been to England. And it brought back memories then because sitting down in the Royal Box and looking at that beautiful grass court just reminded me of, first of all, my dream. When I was 8, I read this Princess magazine story, and the story was about a young girl who was found, trained and taken to this place called Wimbledon, which I didn't know existed. And she played on this magical centre court where she won. So somebody told me later, that place is for real. And I said, oh, okay. So I actually started playing tennis by hitting balls against walls, house walls, water tanks, any wall I could see, with an apple crate board. Once I found out that Wimbledon was for real, that became my dream because every time I hit the ball against the wall, I used to pretend I was there. And every time I went to sleep at night, I would dream about playing on that magical centre court. So that became my first dream.
It must be quite satisfying to find something as a kid that you do that you're so good at.
I didn't know I was good at it. I know that the townspeople of Barrowin, the townspeople kept watching me every day, hitting against the wall, and they entered me in my first sort of coaching school when the coaches came from Sydney. There was a coach called Colin Swan and Faith Martin. They saw me play and they called the coach in Vic Edwards in Sydney, and from then it was to Sydney. I certainly couldn't pay for it, but I had the townspeople pay for my suitcase, my clothes, pay for my trips to Sydney because, you know, we couldn't afford it.
Well, I was actually going to say, obviously you grew up with parents that didn't have a lot of money.
No.
Did that land on you as a negative thing as a kid, or did you?
Oh, no.
Not at all?
Not at all. I mean, I just remember it as being a very... we're always laughing, you know, joking about one thing or another. And there was so much to do. There seemed like a lot to do at the time in Burrellan. I mean, yabbing in the dams and climbing the wheat silos, which I didn't tell Mum at the time. I was very much a tomboy and I played all sports. I played cricket, football, you name it.
There were eight of you in the family, so you almost had your own cricket team, didn't you?
Yes, pretty well, pretty well.
Did you get a sense of, because, I mean, once you just displayed a talent for tennis, you know, did you ever feel bad that you got more attention than your other siblings for being good at tennis? Did they ever make you feel bad about it, or were they quite supportive?
No, not really. They were just, you know, they were just my sisters and brothers as they always were and still today.
Yeah.
In fact, I remember whenever I went to Sydney and then came back to Burrellan, when it was time to say goodbye, my brothers and sisters weren't there. They didn't want to say goodbye. So they really missed having me there, and I missed seeing them. Got very homesick when I first went to Sydney and crying nearly every night.
I'm sure you, especially being from such a big, welcoming family where there's always someone around you who you know so well. I did read in your book that there was this sort of subliminal fear that the welfare man was going to take you away at some point. I mean, was that a real fear or something that your mum used to tell you to do to behave?
Oh, no, it was for real. I remember we used to travel to Griffith and visit my relations at a place called the Three-Way Bridge, and it was a mission there. And in those days it was sort of tin walls and dirt floors and everything, but that, you know, that didn't bother me. I mean, it was just about visiting my relations. But so whenever a shiny cart come down the road, my mum used to say, "You better run and hide. The welfare man will come and take you away." So that was for real because I had some cousins who were taken away.
It's hard for us to.
And so it was a very, very scary time for me, and that's what I remember the most.
When you first moved to Sydney, so Vic Edwards took you under his wing and you moved to Sydney to live with his family so he could train you more closely. You went to Willoughby's Girls' School. For a girl who was so painfully shy, there must have been something very determined in you to even get you on the bus or into the car to take you away. Do you remember what you were feeling on that day that you left your home for the first time to live in a different place?
You know, I was still very shy, very scared, but I do remember getting on the plane and not saying a word until we got to, it was Mrs. Edwards, and we always called, you know, very respectful to call Mr. and Mrs. Edwards. So Mrs. Edwards and daughter Patricia picked me up from the airport, and we got to the Sydney Harbour Bridge, and that's when I finally said something, which was, "Gee, we don't have to pay on our bridge," which is a 4 mile creek outside Burrellan. So it was a real learning experience for me. It was scary, but, you know, I wanted to go there because I think I suddenly realised that there was a little bit of strength there. And I think, thinking back to the time that I had to go and speak to, I went and spoke to the headmaster in Burrellan, and I said, "What do you think? You know, should I go and live there?" And he said the right thing. He said, "Well, I think it's more important that you finish your schooling and your education." And I probably took it the wrong way and I thought, well, you know, maybe he doesn't want me to go and play tennis there. But so when I left the headmaster's office, I just thought, that's it, I'm going. So that moment actually probably gave me a little bit of strength to be able to go. But, you know, I was homesick, but I didn't tell my mother that I was homesick and cried nearly every other night because I didn't want to upset her. And if I told her, she probably would have said, "Come home, don't travel again." And I was scared that she was going to say that, so I never said anything.
To me, it signals already that you had the heart of a champion, because at the end of the day, no one can put that will in you. I mean, people can train you and encourage you, but the want to do it and to win has to come from within you, and you obviously had it. And did it just grow and grow over your experiences in Sydney? I mean, do you remember a moment where you went, "I am going to do everything I can to get to that centre court, that place that I now know is very real.
I think it was always part of my dream all the way through. In fact, the first junior tournament that I played in Sydney, I played Janine Murdoch and she beat me 6-4. It was only one set and then she didn't beat me after that. But that didn't bother me. The fact that I lost, it didn't bother me at all. I just wanted to be out there and play. I just loved it. I mean, I couldn't understand why other players got so upset and the coach telling me you should get that killer instinct. And I thought, I didn't even know what that was. But I just wanted to get out there and play, and I was having a lovely time. In fact, I got the lovely time from I guess, expression from my mother, because whenever I went out to play tournaments, she didn't know anything about tennis, but the one thing, first thing she'd say was, bye, have a lovely day. And then I'd go out and play and win or something, but she never ever asked me, did I win? She'd always say, did you have a lovely day? So that was instilled in me. So I'm out there to have a lovely day, even win or lose.
You certainly seem to have enough lovely days and you certainly had enough wins, didn't you? So
yeah.
Just while we're on the subject, a lot of the tennis champions in history have had some very strong-minded parents who are the opposite of your experience. They are so attached to the results of their children's career that it almost seems to do more damage than good. Do you think that parents can be too overbearing and attached to these things?
Yeah, I think they can be. I never had that pressure at all. Like I said, my mother just wanted me to have a nice day and I was never really pushed when I was living in Burrellan from the townspeople. You know, they didn't say, oh, go out there and win or anything. In fact, I probably wouldn't be sitting here unless they had the initial support of the townspeople of Burrellan. You know, they paid for my suitcase, my clothes, everything to go to Sydney. And in fact, if you're ever near Burrellan, go out and see the big racket.
Did you, at the time, how supportive they were of you, did you understand it at the time or did you more?
Oh,
once
yeah.
You did.
I did understand it because, you know, we couldn't afford anything. And they were the people, the president of the Burrellan Tennis Club, Bill Kurtzman, gave me my first new racket. Before that, I was getting a loan of rackets and before that, it was an apple crate board.
Did you find you could hit them? You find you could hit the ball much more effectively on an actual racket?
Yes.
Or does it take a bit of adjusting to getting about the crate?
I think as I grew bigger and older, I mean, I needed that sort of bigger size racket anyway. I used to get a loan of my dad's boss's wife's, Mrs. Gladman's racket and have a loan of hers. And then one day my younger sister put it in the fire and burnt it. And so my dad had to take that pay out of, you know.
Did she do that just because she needed wood and it was the closest thing handy, or did she do that because she was upset with you?
She thought it was just a toy. So, and in fact, she was the one also that burnt my wooden racket, my first wooden racket.
Oh.
So when I'm travelling around Australia working with Indigenous kids, I take an example of the wooden racket from an apple crate board to show them how I started.
One of the wonderful things about tennis is that it's so international and you've gotten to travel all over the world from this little place that you came from. What are your memories of first seeing countries that, you know, that were so different to your own?
I think I just loved, you know, my first trip to London, not just for the fact that I met my husband there. I loved, you know, sort of walking around to the shops and the shopping and it was just a beautiful place. I mean, I think the last time I went to Wimbledon, I saw it really for the first time. I was a tourist along with my sister. It's such a beautiful city. But also that was where my dream took me.
Was it everything you dreamed it would be?
Actually, it scared the hell out of me. I played one round and then they put me on centre court. And in those days, they don't normally put you on straight on your first time at Wimbledon. They don't put you on centre court. But they did with me because at the time I didn't know that they were writing about me before I even got to the country.
Yeah.
So they put me on centre court. And I remember it was against an American girl named Peaches Bartkowitz. And I remember waiting in the top dressing room and walking along a long corridor, going downstairs and walking another long corridor, and then there's a room where both opponents, they sit together. And all you could hear is the click of the tick of the clock. And so by the time I got out there, I was so scared. I looked up once, I wouldn't look up again. And I just wanted to get off there as quick as possible. So I did. She killed me. But then my coach, Vic Edwards, entered me in the plate event for first and second round losers. So he said, you know, play in this and, you know, maybe we'll get used to playing in this on these grass courts at Wimbledon. Anyway, so I guess it helped because the next year I came back and played the French and won the French. That was my first Grand Slam, actually. And I love playing the French because even though it was a slower surface, I love the fact that you can slide, because I love to be able to slide on grass and our ant bed courts in Borellen. And so I won the French and then came back and won Wimbledon that first time in 71.
People can go, I dream of winning Wimbledon. And the number of people who dream it and the number of people who actually do it are worlds apart. And you are in that rarefied air of someone who actually lived their ultimate sporting dream. When it happened, does it land on you? Did it change your life overnight, or is it surprisingly sort of anticlimactic?
Well, I think the thing that hit me more than anything was coming back here in Sydney and going through a ticker tape parade through the streets. And I thought, why all the fuss, you know? You know, because I beat my hero growing up, Margaret Court, who's our greatest Australian champion and world champion. She beat me most of the time, but she was good practice for me going overseas. And when I finally beat her at Wimbledon, I thought, she's not playing as well as I thought, you know. And I thought, anyway, found out later she was pregnant with her first child.
Right.
So I've thanked Barry since then. And I said, thanks, Barry.
Was she kind in defeat, Margaret?
Yeah, she was always, a wonderful champion. She, you know, we're still very good friends. And in the past, we've played Fed Cup together. Even when I was competing against her in state tournaments, I would stay at her place with Margaret and Barry. And still today, I mean, you know, whenever I go over to Perth, that's where she lives, I go visit. She took us out to dinner and I saw all her trophies. Absolutely amazing.
You talked, we've spoken earlier, you talked about that you were the first person to bring music into the dressing rooms.
Oh, yes.
Tell me how you did this.
I think my companion, when I went through all the homesickness and crying at night, so the one thing that got me through it all was music. I used to listen to records first, obviously, in the 60s. I had a big red transistor radio I used to carry everywhere with me and a tape recorder. And I think that first year I went to Wimbledon, I was playing my tape recorder and Billie Jean came in and said, oh, it's about time we've got some music in here. It's good to hear it.
Great.
And look at it now.
And this obviously a perfect time for us to go to our first song. So what song do you think captures the period of your life we've just discussed?
I think in the very beginning I used to listen to a lot of soul music and I really loved Otis Redding and Dock of the Bay.
The greatest.
I love that song.
I'm Angela Pulvarenti. You're listening to ABC Local Radio. So privileged to have the company of Yvonne Goolagong today. This is a song that got her through homesickness when she first moved to Sydney to become the tennis champion she was going to become. It's the great Otis Redding with Sitting on the Dock of the Bay.
Sitting in the morning sun, I'll be sitting in the evening sun, watching the ships roll in, then I watch them roll away again. Yeah. Sitting on the dock of the bay, watching the tide. Georgia, headed for the Frisco Bay.
watching the tide roll away. Sitting on a darker bay, wasting time. Look like nothing's gonna change. Everything still remains the same. I can't do what 10 people tell me.
Listening to Inside Edge with Angela Pulverenti.
Taking you inside the hearts and minds of our greatest sporting champions. Welcome back to Inside Edge. I'm, of course, with a living legend, Yvonne Goolagong, and we've been joined by her dashing husband, Roger Cawley. He is so dashing.
And he's still
I can't say it enough. And I'm so honoured. This is the first time the two of you have ever been interviewed side
by
side.
That's right. It is.
We spoke a little earlier, Yvonne, and you said that one of the secrets to your the longevity of your marriage to Roger is that you love doing the same things and that you've both gotten so much joy out of building this foundation together, the Yvonne Goolagong Foundation, and the work that you've been able to do giving back to Indigenous kids. Would it have been possible in the same way without Roger?
I don't think so, because I can't think of anybody else who knows me as well as Roger. You know, over the years we've become really close. We're really good friends. We both love doing the same things. And when we came back to Australia in 92, I decided that I wanted to do something to help other Aboriginal kids achieve their dreams too. So we got together and talked about it, and Roger organised the whole
program.
Figured
something out.
You about it, Roger, you get as much joy out of this as Yvonne does, I can tell.
I think this is the happiest and most important time of our lives. I don't think there's anything that we've done in the past, either of us, that even remotely compares with it. We've spent 18 years, about to hit in a few days' time, actually the start of the 18th year we've been doing this. I think we've hit on the formula that produces the results that we want. And we, along with everybody else in the country, know that education is the most important thing to help solve what can be termed the Indigenous problem here. And we feel it's quality education. So we've gotten involved over the years with a number of schools across the country, right here in Sydney. Pymble Ladies College is an outstanding example.
Yeah.
We have 13 girls in the Indigenous program there this year, whereby the kids get an opportunity to experience the very best. And we found that the social conscience of various schools and headmasters around the country has gotten bigger and bigger as we've gotten into this thing. And we've been very, very lucky to place a number of kids, and we've been lucky that the kids themselves have reacted the right way. In Yvonne's message to them, there's a two-line thing in her ambassador message, and it says that we want to help kids who want to help themselves. And that's the important part.
Sometimes kids come from such challenging environments that they don't even know how to go about that. Do you ever get overwhelmed with just the sadness of the circumstances that some kids come from?
Well, I think through our program, and we've seen it already, that we can help them, you know, grow, because this is like an incentive-based program where we do come and try. We monitor the kids. As long as they stay in school and attend their lessons, we do give free coaching lessons to about 7 of the kids in each place we go. And from there, if they stay in school, they can attend the state camps, which we'll be holding on Saturday and Sunday.
People think we're college. Doing a tennis program, but it really isn't. It's, yes. If you want to help yourself and you show that kind of enthusiasm to people who are now working, I won't say for us, but with us, have actually come through the program themselves and they know what we're looking for. And they're not so much the athletic ability isn't ignored, obviously. We're not going to turn away someone who could be another Yvonne, but we're more interested in just the ones that really might be able to survive the entire program and get to the scholarship level whereby they can go through school and on into university and go back and help their people. And that's
build
what it's
their
about.
Confidence.
That's right.
Because
that's
even
right.
if you hadn't happened to be as amazing at tennis as you were, the tennis journey you took was always going to take you to a better life no matter what, wasn't
that's
it?
That's right. Well, I remember, you know, when I started doing really well, you know, at tournaments and so on in Borellan, it gave me so much confidence in myself. And I was at a stage where I wouldn't even say boo to anybody. And then it enabled me to give me confidence to actually go to school and actually speak, you know, to the teachers. And it wasn't all the time, though, was it?
Haven't shut her up since. No, I think it's true. I think it's true. The kids all she'll say that and they don't believe it when you think what she's done.
And who she's met and where she's been.
Yeah, but I was very much like a lot of those kids that, you know, first come to the come and try days, actually.
We had a boy, his name's Roland Archie from Alice Springs, who's now at university in Adelaide. And he spoke at our state camp in Adelaide for the other week. And really, when I think about it, he just volunteered, but he was the perfect example because he had come through the program. He was a bright kid. He changed from tennis to AFL, back to AFL. We went to put at a school, the Southport School on the Gold Coast, and then decided that he wasn't going to become Pete Sampras in 10 minutes. And we told him, no, you know, it's not going to happen.
No.
But he said, I can play AFL. So he went down to Melbourne Grammar, and he was taken on by the Gold Coast franchise, the new franchise on the AFL. But right at the end of his three-year contract, just as they were about to play, he smashed his shoulder. And he learned the other side of things, where they didn't say, Roland, we love you, and no doubt they did. They said, Roland, it's the end of your contract. Go away and fix yourself, and we'll have another look at you.
Yeah.
And it's never gotten right. The other day he came in with a sling on his shoulder, having gone through his third, I think, operation. He's doing very, very well at university. And he pointed, just like Yvonne does sometimes, I was just like you. He pointed at a little eight-year-old boy, and he said, when I was your size, she found me. And right throughout this, where I wanted to become just like Yvonne in sport, she was pressing on me, stay in school. And I wouldn't be standing here at university today if it wasn't for her.
That
which I thought was
pretty much
perfect.
Embodies everything you're trying to achieve, isn't it? It must be very rewarding. Is it almost more rewarding than winning Wimbledon?
Yes. I'm so much more happy. I mean, I know I was very happy, you know, to achieve my dream. This actually program is my second dream, and Roger's been helping me achieve that dream, is to try and sort of influence the lives and make sure that a lot of these young people find their dreams too.
Would you say that you have discovered most about your Indigenous culture, what it means, the beautiful aspects of it? Have you discovered most of that as an adult? Have you had to sort of, you know, because you're this the Indigenous role model, and did you sort of feel like, wow, I need to find out more about what it actually means?
Yes, that happened when we first came back to Australia, wasn't it? And we decided to do a book, and it was all about trying to find my Aboriginality, and I'm still learning. I'm just learning that it's a very powerful and it's a wonderful culture. I mean, through it all, I have so much more respect for my elders, whatever country they come from. And so when we do these camps, these state camps, we have a big map of all the Indigenous countries from around Australia, and so they put a dot on where they come from. So at the same time, they're learning more about their culture too, which a lot of them, you know, don't know much that about it.
If I could just take you back to the moment where the two of you met, because I know that Yvonne, you sort of mentioned to me previously that you were sort of Roger's friend and your friend were into each other. And so you two got stuck on a night where you were sort of the tag-alongs.
Yes.
And that you immediately thought he was a very lovely man, but it wasn't necessarily sparks flying. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, at the time, I think, you know, I remember, Roger, you came up to me and said, oh, I'm sorry you're not having a good time or something like that. I was trying to get home. And anyway, I found out that Patricia was dating your friend, and I thought, oh, well, I better wait. So we were tag-alongs, and I remember they told us to get out of the car, and we end up dancing on some golf course.
The 17th green, I think.
There you go.
Guildford Golf.
He even knows the hole.
Oh, it's a very difficult hole.
So you were both tennis players.
Yes. Yeah. I was a tennis player of sorts. I thought
you were a very good player, right?
When I was young, younger. I was always thinking I should be like Yvonne. And I met Yvonne and a guy called Ilya Nastasi within about 3 or 4 months, who were both, in my opinion, two of the big geniuses of tennis. They didn't win everything in sight, but they could do more with the ball. And I just went and did something else straight away.
When you first met Yvonne, were you aware of her tennis abilities then?
Unlike Yvonne, I mean, I actually read newspapers. Her coach would never let her read anything, which was probably a very sensible thing.
Actually, I
think don't believe in what you read, believe in yourself. So I never read anything.
Yeah,
if you're not going to believe it anyway, why read it,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
But I did play tennis as a junior, so you couldn't avoid hearing about someone like Yvonne.
Of course. But were you thinking quite instantly, this woman is amazing, I want to make her mine?
I don't know if that's quite right. I know she made me laugh more than anybody else I've met in a long time, and it seemed to work quite well both ways. But I do remember when, at the end of the first year, after spending an incredibly embarrassing number of times dodging Vic Edwards, her coach, in order just to see her once or twice, I do remember at the airport feeling that I was pretty much gone. I'm not sure that happened to Yvonne until about 2 years ago, but
he grows on you, obviously.
Yeah.
I was actually part of her first nightmare rather than her second dream.
Well, that is obviously not true, Roger. Yeah. I mean, the two of you, however you came together, it's just been such a wonderful relationship and partnership. Now, before you got married, of course, you had to take this dashing man back to...
To Borellen. Yes.
Dashing. I left my horse outside.
And I'll tell you something, he's getting more dashing, I think, as he gets older, but just quietly. But, Roger, talk me through going back to this small country town.
The first time.
And meeting this extensive family. I mean, what are your most indelible memories of it?
I've got to tell you before he says anything that... I told Roger, I said, I know exactly what my mum's going to say when you get there. She's going to say, I hope you're not flash.
But
anyway.
I am? Oh.
But he is quite flash, isn't he? I mean, did he look quite awkward or did he fit in fairly effortlessly?
Did you, Rog?
You tell me.
No, you fit in really well. I mean, everybody just loved you. In the very beginning.
I'll say this, that I learnt more in my first week in Australia about Yvonne's folks, about Aboriginal people, than I had in the previous 5 years of writing to Yvonne. Because for me, it was just this vague concept of what an Aboriginal is. And I think true of my generation in England, if anybody who hadn't travelled here. And when I came to Brolin, we showed up at this house, at Yvonne's house, for parents' house. And there's, I don't know how many bedrooms there were, five
bedrooms.
But there were a lot of people already there. But we left to go to the airport. We're getting married, church blessing the next day.
Church of England, yes.
In Borrell. And I had invited one person. There's only one person I knew. So I invited a guy, a physiotherapist called Paul Denny, who'd travelled with Yvonne overseas. And we went to Narandra, about 40 miles away, and to pick him up and came back. And there had to be about 80 to 90 Gulalongs now in the
everywhere.
Same house.
And couldn't see the house.
But the important part of it was after we had to go down to the local pub to change for the wedding, but there was no room at the house anymore. When we had the wedding, which was hysterical in itself, the blessing, beautiful evening, the party went on all night. and all of the TV folks were there, had down cameras and join in because there was nowhere else to go and there was nowhere to sleep. The local pub has 8 rooms and so the party went necessarily on all night. But for the next 4 or 5 days, these people, these goolagongs and others, did not go. And I was trying to think what my old man would do if about 80 vaguely connected relations showed up and camped in the living room for the next week.
He
was a nice man, but not like this. It really was a learning,
family.
And I learned that exactly what Aboriginal people do. Yeah. What they have, they share. And I think it's one of the most likable things. And I understand now why part of Ivona is the way she is.
I know that we're jumping back and forth a little, but I did want to just touch on the fact that Roger was obviously your practicing partner after you got married. What was it like training together?
Oh, it was great. I mean, Roger was always a very good player and he always knew how to sort of feed the balls to me and let me win. No.
But the thing is, he would have known your game so well. So
I did after a while. Yeah, I was pretty hopeless in the beginning. I hadn't played in about 4 or 5 years and I can remember being really embarrassed. I mean, the first people I hit alongside at the place we lived on Hilton Head was Rod Laver and someone else. I mean... It's pretty embarrassing. I mean, that guy was like.
It's a pretty intense weekend tennis game, isn't it?
Yeah.
We did train together with Bjorn Borg at the Extra Club before Wimbledon in 1980.
But it was a good time, and I know what you're getting at because we were the first of male female partnerships on the tennis court, and I do remember at a time having a flash of wisdom. Probably alcohol-induced or something. But I remember saying to somebody at a newspaper once that one day when people can afford to do this, when the money really is in the game, it makes sense for every woman to have
a stronger partner.
The males are nowhere near as good. I mean, I can't even dream of the way Yvonne can return things in different ways. It doesn't even enter my mind. I just get it back. With a male partner, at least they get pushed, and that's pretty much the way it is now.
Isn't it?
There's a lot of them around.
Well, when you got married, Yvonne, in both your minds, you weren't thinking this is the end of Yvonne's career, or even
Actually, I was.
You were.
That's what she told me.
Right.
There were various problems at the time. I don't think her coach much appreciated my interest in Yvonne, and whilst that was a somewhat difficult period and we got over it, Yvonne had decided that she was going to stop. So when we got married, we were going to fulfil the rest of her obligations in 1975, which I think lasted from July at Wimbledon to November, and stop. But in that time, she seemed to feel that she had gotten free of whatever constraints or whatever problems there were, and she is actually starting to play pretty well as well.
Mm. Well, it's an interesting thing, Yvonne, isn't it? Not to labour on it, though, but obviously Vic Edwards was a major part in bringing you from a certain point to another point. But there comes a time in every person's life where they want to be operating under their own steam. And I guess it's always difficult to extricate yourself from a mentor like that. Would you say that's true?
It was probably a big release, really, for me.
Yeah.
And I felt so much more freer about sort of getting out there and playing and doing it again for myself and trying to achieve that dream one more time, which I did after having Kelly.
When you had Kelly, did you ever imagine you'd be stepping back onto centre court again? You hadn't ruled it out?
No, not at all.
I can remember at our house on Hilton Head, there were 2 breakwaters on the beach in front of our house. And I don't know how many days it was after she had Kelly by cesarean, with stitches and so on. But she was already starting to walk up and down. I remember sitting on the balcony, worried that she was going to hurt herself really badly. But she started straight away. She'd walk up to the breakwater and back and up and back. And then she was jogging as the weeks went by, and then they let her get back on the court.
Tell me about the experience. There you are, a little family with a 3-year-old girl going to Wimbledon. It must have been, as you say, you're free, you're on your own steam, you're playing the way you want, your life is as you want it. It must have been such a contrasting experience to 1971. But tell me how.
Well, I just felt really happy. I know that after I had Kelly, I just felt great. I just wanted to get out there. I felt like I had so much energy. Mm-hmm. But after Kelly, I mean, I just, you know, I felt like I wanted to keep playing. And it was great. It was great.
I was. I had the whip. I mean, yeah. I might have had to work for a living. I mean, this would have been terrible.
And that was just striking so much fear in you. You said, come on.
No, actually, I won the Australian Open before.
Yeah, of course.
Wimbledon.
Yeah.
As a mother.
And so that would have given you a lot of confidence.
So that gave me a lot of confidence for Wimbledon in 80 then. So.
But when she won, because there's a fantastic in the footage, it flashes to you looking like a young Cliff Richard in the
he was about four rows behind me,
which is so amazing. People must have gotten you mixed up. You really did look a little like him, yeah, don't you think?
Yeah, he did. Didn't you think so, Rog?
Absolutely.
What was it like after you won in 1980 at Wimbledon?
I know that at the time playing against Chris Evert, who was a really tough competitor. I was feeling so good before the actual match and, you know, as Roger said earlier, I felt so good during that whole week and each match that I played I was feeling stronger and I was feeling quicker and that's why I went, you know. I thought, well, just hitting against the wall would be fine just to get my timing going. So by the time I got out on the court, I was ready. I won the first set, playing really well, but then it rained and then I had to come off and I thought, oh, no, because she'll start playing much better. And she did. Mm. And so we played, I think it was a tiebreaker in the second.
First ever tiebreaker in a Wimbledon final.
At Wimbledon, yeah.
If you want to collect that sort of stuff.
That's right.
So it was really very satisfying winning in 80. First of all, in 1971, achieving my dream in 71. But in 80... it meant so much more to me, I think, because after having Kelly as a mother, I felt happy and I felt great and I felt energetic and I was ready to win that year.
What kind of things happen to you when you win Wimbledon? I mean, who writes to you or calls you or...?
I don't know, but the first person, as Yvonne got off that court, the first person to say anything to her said something that I've been telling her for years, like we both knew,
yeah,
he said.
Yes. One of the officials came up to me even before I went to shake Chris's hand and he said, and did you know you're the first mother since Dorothy Lambert Chambers in 1914? And that's all he said. I thought, oh, okay.
Yes. So,
then I went up and shook her hand.
How do you decide to celebrate it?
I think you just go, I mean, you're sort of on a high, but you just feel numb at the same time.
Yeah.
So you go through all the motions of celebrating and the Wimbledon ball and everything. And then it didn't really hit me until I got back to Hilton Head and got back home and a few days later or a week later and I thought, oh, I just did that.
Yeah.
That must be good.
But if you're asking, did we celebrate? Yes, we didn't go to bed.
We literally danced
all night.
Yeah, and I love to dance.
Yvonne then went. The Wimbledon ball was the next night after what became one of the great finals in Wimbledon history, Borg and McEnroe the second time around.
Of course.
And we did not go to bed. Yvonne went shopping. I took a friend to watch that final and my eyelids propped out. And then that match went on so long. We ended up going to a place at the Hilton Hotel called Trader Vic's just to have a drink, one of those rum. In those days, I made Yvonne have a drink. She doesn't drink at all now. But I remember the night mostly because someone, I don't know if it was you or somebody else, had given me a very nice watch. And going up in the lift from the car park, these three little London kids were going, hey, Rog, Yvonne, God, that was a great final, wasn't it? That was fantastic. And they were jostling us around. And we got in there and sat down and this bloke gave us this drink. And I said, well, we've got to wait till this match is over and we're going to wherever it was, whether Savoy Hotel, where the Wimbledon thing was. And Yvonne said, well, what time is it? And I went, and I had no watch.
They took your watch.
I loved it. So if you're watching, whoever you are, I remember exactly who it was.
Why don't we go? This seems like a great place to go to the second song. So you can just set up for me. You're choosing Michael Jackson's Thriller, which I have to say was not the song I thought you were going to back up Otis Redding with, but it makes perfect sense.
Nah, well, at the time, in 80, that's the music that was around at that time. So we played it all the time.
One of the best albums of all time.
We played it on the way to practice and on the way back, and I think it became pretty much like, I don't think we ever say superstitious, but I think every single day we played it, going there and back, and it was just part of the thing.
I'm Angela Pulvarenta. You're listening to ABC Local Radio. This is Michael Jackson's Thriller. This is the song that helped Roger Corley and Yvonne Goolagong get Yvonne to that fantastic Wimbledon win in 1980.
funk of 40,000 years and grisly ghouls from every tomb are closing in to seal your doom. And though you fight to stay alive, your body starts to shiver, for no immortal can resist the evil of the thriller.
This is Inside Edge with Angela Pulverinti
on ABC Local Radio.
One thing that I do think is just wonderful about the story of you winning the 1980 Wimbledon Grand Final is that you, and this is that beautiful full circle moment in life, is that you went right back to where you originally started when you were in the lead up by hitting the ball against the wall again, didn't you, Yvonne?
That's right.
Despite having any court available to you in the whole of London.
That's
tell
right.
me more about that.
Well, I was actually feeling so good at the time that I decided I just needed a warm-up and hit against a wall. And so we went to Queen's Club and I hit against the wall just to get my timing going again and went straight out to Wimbledon. And that's something I really didn't mention for years after during an interview in Japan, and Chris Evert was sitting beside me. And one of the questions was, and what did you do to prepare yourself for Wimbledon in
1980? Nice Japanese accent.
That was just it was just a slight Japanese accent, wasn't it? Like, didn't overdo it.
Whatever. Yeah. Anyway.
A little more ginger.
I told that story that I went and hit against the wall. And Chris leant over and said, "You what?"
Because she thought that was just kind of preposterous, really.
Yeah. Yes, she did.
But really, it's the perfect round out to the way she started. And we do that with the Indigenous kids on our Come and Try days. Yvonne tells them the story and then I get down on my knees and hit with a paddle. I usually pick on somebody in the front row and say, "She was about your size." And only once has somebody burst into tears.
That's right.
But anyway, we do that and we emphasise it because it is a beginning and an end. Mm. I mean, Yvonne that day was sort of like a little girl. She was back to being a little girl again. And before a Wimbledon final these days, I doubt that anybody would just go spend 20 minutes bashing a ball against the wall.
The other great thing about that story is that really, I guess all of us in life, the one person that we truly are in battle with the whole way through was ourselves. And hitting against the wall is just being in that battle with yourself, because you actually used to write how many times you'd do it without...
In the dirt.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the next day...
Try and beat that score.
And did you always do it?
Yes.
Yeah.
I always beat it. And I wouldn't leave until I'd beaten that score. So it got higher and higher. And I can't remember how many I did, but that's what kept me on the wall every day.
Yvonne Goolagong, Roger Cawley, thank you so much for joining us on Inside Edge. It's been an absolute pleasure.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
This is Inside Edge with Angela Pulverinti.
It's a chance to make a dream become reality, really.
It was unfortunate. When I was 13, I lost my dad and he died in a work accident. So it was a pretty tough time sort of growing up dealing with that sort of thing.
But... Oh, the Fijian flyer! He'll bring them to their feet!
Tune in tomorrow when I speak with the incomparable Ita Buttrose and her good friend and colleague Ainsley Kale. That's The Truth About Us at 11 a.m. on ABC Local Radio. I'm Angela Pulverinti. See you then.